Hello, everybody. So before we begin Sweeney versus Bard, our first episode of the season and our return to core Sweeney versus Bard, I would like to just let everybody know that we're doing courses this fall at Parallax. And our first course starts Sunday, September 10th. It's with Benita Roy, who is an amazing Taoist philosopher, human being, horse whisperer. And it's based around the thought of Ivan Illich. It's called Bonita Roy, the Convivial Life Conversation with Ivan Illich. So if there's any Bardians out there or friends who want to come and join us for this course, I'm really plugging it because I think it will be extremely special. So please check it out. I'll put descriptions in the link below. And we also have a course with Layman Pascal and OG Rose and all kinds of people coming up, but this will be our inaugural course for the beginning of September. So check out our courses at Parallax, and now enjoy a conversation with Alexander Bard.
Okay,
welcome to Sweeney versus Bard. We're going back to the old brand, the old name.
And we're going back to core.
Yeah. Because we started this thing and it was powerful and it was a chance for you to go deep, I think, into your philosophy. You've just published a book, Process and Event.
I have. Let's do the promotion part here. Like if I'm on your talk show. This is the book. It sold out everywhere. It's hard to get hold of. It just blew everybody's brains out last week. But it's now there. It's a fact. It cannot be changed or anything. It's released. Process of Event. And you're mentioning it, Andrew, several times. And many of our friends from the intellectual deep web are mentioned. Some are not mentioned. It wasn't intentional. I want to credit everybody who's been involved in the process of making Process an Event. But the event has happened. The book's out.
Wonderful. Out. Yeah. And so it's out. The sixth in your trilogy. I've read all the others. I can't wait to get my hands on this beast of a book and go through it.
That you said the sixth in the trilogy.
Oh,
yeah. It's the third in the second trilogy.
It's the sixth book. There's my.
It's your fantastic, beautiful mind jumping again to conclusions in weird sentences.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a Gestalt guy. I always get the details wrong at times. That's true.
The messiest podcast ever, Sweeney versus Bard, or as we also call it, Autists of the World Unite.
Autists of the World Unite. Okay. And I want to also say that Parallax is having a course with Bonita Roy, an amazing course called The Convivial Life with Bonita Roy. And I think some of Alexander's fans should know about this and should join us. It starts Sunday, September 10th.
Bonita Roy is awesome, guys. And not only is she one of the most intelligent women on the planet, she's also an expert on Ivan Illich and his work, and I really appreciate her coming over to Parallax. So what did you do, Andrew? You managed to get both Bonita Roy and Layman Pascal to jump the ocean and join you in Paris at Parallax.
Yeah.
What happened? Yeah. The brightest minds of North America are flocking to Andrew Sweeney in Paris.
They're flocking to Parallax.
What? Yeah. Are you like a secret billionaire, or is there some other hidden secret, I don't know yet, that you get these guys to join Parallax?
Really not. It's all my charm, Alexander. It's nothing but that. Anyway, so we're talking maybe, you know, in our discussion before the podcast, we're talking about going deeper and the fact that this podcast is going to be about going deeper into many of the things that we've already discussed and launching and jumping off from process and an event. So we want to go deeper into religion, philosophy, and anthropology. Am I correct? Are those the main areas of concern? Yeah.
So we are literally living in the middle of a paradigm shift. That's our language at Parallax for what the Americans call the meaning crisis. A meaning crisis is the result of a paradigm shift historically. So we're moving into a whole new paradigm. It's going to be messy and chaotic. And this is the kind of work we're doing. That means that what you must do is to rearrange your worldview and figure out what part of your worldview is eternal and was always identical, and what part of your worldview is paradigmatic must be adjusted according to the times you live in. This is what we call archetypology and paradigmatics in our work. Mm-hmm. Archetypology is that which stays the same over the paradigms. Paradigmatics is that which is exclusive for the internet age or the digital age, in what way power is constructed and how meaning is constructed and purpose is constructed. So mm-hmm. this is what we're doing. And listen, anything else you're doing like academia or politics or working with mass media, you know, or you know, working in the old industry, if you're still doing advertising and marketing, which is like the slavery of the 21st century, like get out as quickly as you can. Anywhere you work in the old institutions that are now trying to corrupt the algorithms for us, or manipulate the algorithms for us, or conform the algorithms for us so that we become what they want us to be instead of us having algorithms designed for us. So we own our ontological design, as Daniel Fraga says. So that we own our ontological design and create ourselves, right? This is what's important at the times we live in. And that's the only place to go, is to go to the merger of philosophy and religion, mm-hmm. where they meet. We have to go theological rather than just philosophical, because theology is deep philosophy. And this is why, for me and John, after we wrote the first trilogy, the Futurica trilogy, which was philosophical, we went theological when we wrote the Grand Narratology, which is now finished. The Synthesis book, the Digital Libido book, and Present Event, where you guys contributed both to Digital Libido, and a lot of you guys contributed to Present Event. And that's why there's more credits to intellectual deep web people in Prosimenta, the credits to books we've studied, right?
So what part of is theological and what part is philosophical?
Well, if theos is the name for the ultimate or the absolute, then theology is the ultimate philosophy or the philosophy of the absolute. This is fundamentally Hegel, right? So say you're an atheist. Okay. You're an atheist, meaning you do not believe in God. Well, then you've got an idea what kind of God it is you don't believe in. As I always say, that the problem with being an atheist is that you've got so many thousands of gods you must oppose. That's going to get very, very tiresome when you do it, but that's okay. I think it's better to start with the position that atheism, which I call it instead of atheism, atheism is basically the negation. So start with the negation. That's what Hegel does so brilliantly. So a guy who does this wonderfully, although he and I don't even speak to each other for at least 12 months, is Cato Last. Cato Last is a fucking genius. He invented the word negatology. Negatology means that everything starts with something lacking. So when we all believe that everything in the world is the eternal recurrence of the same, somebody we love dies. Mm-hmm. The death of somebody we love was the precursor to the event. This is Cadell's genius. That's what we call negatology, and credit to Cadell Last in this book. The negatology means that when everything was a repetition of the same, when everything was a nomadology, when everything was a religion that was identical to all human beings because we were constantly moving to survive, we're nomadic. Then when somebody died, we had to make up a story about the death of that person, a myth about that person, and how we confronted the death of somebody we loved.
So in a way, death is the beginning of the story.
This is what Hegel taught us. Death is the absolute. Mm-hmm. Cadell took it seriously, developed the negatology. I then developed the eventology with John Söderqvist, and we credit Cadell for his work. And then we went on, John Söderqvist and I. That's why Cadell and I didn't write a book together, because he should do the negatology on his own. He's brilliant. But we did Process and Event being John Söderqvist. And the pointer is that once we realize that somebody dies, it leaves a negation. And the fact that it leaves a negation like a hole or a void, it's something we can fill with something new. The death of somebody we love makes it possible for us to find a new person to love and fill that gap with. Mm-hmm. So when the grandfather dies, our sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters fill the gap of the dying grandfather who's gone. And then we teach our sons and daughters that they had a fantastic grandfather. He's a forefather. And that's the beginning of religion. Yeah. So this is where the East and the West agree. You know, the Chinese don't have a word for gods. They don't get it. They only have words for forefathers and foremothers. So the original gods were the forefathers or the foremothers. And then throughout history, civilization is the process of how you deal with death and how you deal with creating an event on top of the death.
Yeah.
That's what civilization is.
That crosses over with Girard a little bit.
Exactly. Well, it does. Yeah. It does. Where Girard is both right and wrong. I'm working my way through Sloterdijk at the moment. I'll get back to Sloterdijk and why I have to work with him, because he's very productive and most philosophers aren't these days. But the problem with Sloterdijk is he doesn't get the fundamental difference between Persia and Egypt, because as most Westerners, he doesn't get Persia, right? What was the difference between Persia and Egypt? The difference was that Egypt and their attitude towards death was to build pyramids, mausoleums, until they wasted the entire fucking national budget on building pyramids and were ruined and never rose to prominence ever again. Egypt was done after the Bronze Age. And ever
it was
since
a death cult, in a sense.
It was a death cult. It wasn't even a death cult. It was a cult of the eternity beyond death. It was a cult. It was the ultimate cult of the afterlife.
Yeah.
Okay? The Persians learned early that that would be a terrible mistake, because they didn't live by rivers. They lived in mountainous areas. And if you live in mountainous areas, you might think differently about the world. Oh. Right? So what they figured out was that, no, let's not spend money on the dead. Let's try to understand what death teaches us. What death teaches us, that if you've lived a long life full of wisdom, you're a worthy role figure to look up to. So you're a forefather or a foremother. Okay? Mm-hmm. If you're a forefather, foremother, you should be celebrated every day, the day you died, for the next 70 years. And the person is called this Palgasar. It's one of the most beautiful rituals ever invented. Every day on the day of your death, you'll be celebrated for the next 70 years. And what we're celebrating is the memory of you, because you were lucky enough to live a full life, a horvatat, meaning we can turn you into an eternal life for us, an amiritat, meaning you're with us, even if you're dead, because your memory is with us, and we aspire to be like you, and we aspire to live the way you lived.
Yeah, I think the Jews and the Tibetans do that as well in a different way.
Exactly.
With the Kaddish, with the Jews. And
you're way smarter than Sloterdijk already right here, Andrew. That's exactly my point. This is the frustration with Western thinking. So the Persians taught you, no matter how hard it was, to take the corpse of the dead person out into the forest and feed it to the animals as animal feed.
Yeah.
The Tibetans.
But there's also this long process,
you
know, where you take the body and feed it to the vultures and then grind the bones down to dust. And then, you know, for days before and days after, you stay with the body. You know, it's a psychological to deal with the death.
You're allowed to grieve. Exactly. Yeah. You should grieve.
There's a
that.
Grieving process and a passing on process. And that's very.
It's
very
called the sky funeral.
And very, very elaborate.
Yeah, sure. But you realize in that process that the person is gone and is no longer there. So therefore, you put the body is not the person. There's nobody there to talk to any longer. There's nobody there to say hi to any longer.
The body is not the person. That
no,
I agree with
the
you.
Part of you that had a relationship with that person is also dead. The relationship between you and that person is dead. The part of you that was that person is also dead. Part of you is dead too.
Yeah.
Death.
But something also, you know, something is continued. That is, whatever your contribution is or whatever you've put into the world continues. In a sense,
exactly.
Like your books continue or whatever.
Yeah. Exactly. So the smart way of looking at this is that there's a reincarnation. The reincarnation is the reincarnation of the archetype. So if a fantastic woman That's died, we try to look for a young girl who could be her.
Yeah.
Or if an old wise man dies, we try to look for a young boy who could be him. Now, this is prominent in Buddhism and Taoism and Zoroastrianism.
Yeah.
In these religions, you go and try to find somebody who can replace the archetype. Just imagine that the archetype is still there. It's not the same person being reborn, because there's no memory. Without memory, there's no selfhood. So since the memory is gone, but the archetype is being reborn, reincarnation is about the reincarnation of the archetype.
That's why people think that they used to be Napoleon, or it's always somebody historical or known, or Because that, because
yeah, if there's Shirley MacLaine or something like that, they're a celebrity, right?
An archetype.
Okay. Yeah, but most people want to be something fancy, like a pharaoh of Egypt. I always say we should have more Ukrainian peasants among the people who say they were born.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I was a Ukrainian peasant in my previous life, or maybe I wasn't even human. Whatever, a pig. Right. That's more credible because it's more likely. So no. You're not the reincarnation of a famous person or some successful person or anything like that at all. You're just yourself. You're a unique self. And here is what Hegel is absolutely correct. Your subjectivity starts again with a negation. Mm-hmm. And it is a negation. And there is nothing there. And because there is nothing there, you throw things into that void your entire life. So this is, again, a perfect way to do theology first. First, theology should be a theology.
Yeah, or what about apophatic? Like, do you ever think in that terms? Because that is defining God by negativity.
It's a bit too cheap, right? I know Orthodox Christianity is onto it and all that. Well, I don't want to stay there because I think theology is kind of boring if you end up in only one of its four potential outcomes. This is the Synthism book. Yeah. You can also do pantheology.
Mm-hmm.
The world that exists is God. God is self-creating. God is its own creation.
What's the opposite of I forget.
It's certainly positive.
There's the negativity and then there's the carnality as well. So that's the other side.
It's not only carnality, it's everything that exists. Mm-hmm. It's ontology, basically. So your thinking and your perceptions and even the things that aren't material, whatever they are, everything you could imagine has some kind
cataphatic,
of ontological
existence. That's the word I was looking for. There's apophatic and cataphatic. Yeah. Anyway.
But we can't understand theology unless we allow ourselves to think that God is its own creation and therefore the universe and God are the same thing. And the reason why we do pantheology is because we then arrive at monism and we arrive at holism. Everything in the universe affects everything else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Söderqvist and I are so radical that we even say that your thoughts affect your physiology.
Of course. Yeah. That's not that radical for the East. It's kind of radical for a Western person.
Yeah. It's radical to say that all the different emergence vectors that exist in the universe have an effect on one another, but it's proper monism and it's proper holism, and we're radical about our monism and our holism. We have no reason to leave monism at all. You know my enemies, always the Gnostics and their dualism.
Yeah.
It's always my enemy. It's still Plato and Heidegger today. That's why I have a problem with Sloterdijk, right? So it's still the enemy we're fighting. Anyway, the Persians put the corpses out there, and they've had a different relationship towards death. And the Persian empires in different forms lasted for 2,200 years. A better model. The Roman Empire was modeled on the Persians. Confucius and the Chinese had to develop a Chinese imperial model based on the Persians. The Indians did their different tryouts as well to do different versions of the Persian Empire. But the Persian Empire was the first empire. And the concept of empire was developed by Persians successfully, whereas the Egyptians failed. The Egyptians invented dictatorship. The Persians invented the power-sharing empire.
Okay, so that's kind of the interesting thing here to me is that the relationship to death is so key to what makes a successful empire or political organization or society or psychology, everything.
Yeah.
Is in some sense related to that negativity.
And we are more radical here because we go deeper. We go into the East and we go into all cultures, and we can study Peru and Mexico. The problem of reading somebody like Sloterdijk today, whose trilogy, The Spheres, his spherology, is parallel with Baden Söderqvist's grand narratology.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got to study Sloterdijk, you study his three books, The Bubbles of the Foams of the Globes. You study them. He's a philosopher of space. And you're starting in parallel with Synthism, Digital Libido, and Process and Event by Baden Söderqvist because we're philosophers of time. And you realize the difference between us being radically Hegelian and Deleuzian, whereas Sloterdijk stays with Plato and Heidegger.
So is the East about the philosophy of space and the West about the philosophy of time?
No. East is about the philosophy of time.
Okay.
The West is obsessed with Plato with the philosophy of space.
It's the inverse because I think of space as being a shunyata, being a central concept of Buddhist and Taoist philosophy, whereas I kind of think of time and historical movement being more, you know, more in the Abrahamic traditions, like
not at
moving towards the promised land.
No, you're mixing linear with indexing linear with circular.
Okay.
They're both time, right?
Okay.
The problem is that a circular philosophy sees the eternal repetition of the same, and that's fundamentally India, and I would say to a large extent China. This is the East.
Yeah.
Dominates circular thinking, which we call hypertime. The problem with linear time, which the Persians developed, but never allowed to leave circular time. In Zoroastrianism, linear time and circular time operate in parallel. Zoroastrianism is the religion of process and event. This is a Zoroastrian manifesto.
So process and event is circle and line meeting.
Together, yeah. So you have two different ways of looking at time. Because the problem is that when you disconnect linear time from circular time, you get Christianity and Islam. You get Gnostic thinking. And then what happens, and here's the irony, when you only have linear time, you get obsessed with space. That's exactly the problem with Plato. When you have linear time only.
You have to unpack that a bit. I'm not sure if I get it.
Okay, so what happens when you got linear time is space time. Circular time is hyper time. It's time independent of space, as if it's prior to space. Then space can be added to that, but space is conditional on time. That's Eastern thinking. Okay. Mm-hmm. Western thinking is the idea, because of Islam and Christianity, although Judaism and Zoroastrianism and all the mystics disagree, but the dominant forms of Islam, the scholarly forms of Islam and Christianity, the Islam of the mullahs and the imams, the Christianity of the popes and the reformers, all agree, the Gnostic fundamentally, in that they only accept linear time. So there's a beginning, a birth of the world. There's the fall. Sin is introduced to the world, and anything that you and I love called Tantra is hidden behind the veil called sin. We must never ever go there. It's this childish, infantile idea that you get when you get linear time. But here's the problem. Linear time fundamentally is space-time as first condition, meaning that space is there from the very beginning. This is why Western science ends up with absurd idea. But the most beginning of space time. And then they say, but then before the space time, there isn't. They can't even use language. There's no language to speak before space time if you think space time is fundamental, which is obvious to me, means that hyper time must be there all the time, and you must do hyper time and space time in parallel. This is the first chapter process of it. We lay out exactly what you need to think both circular and linear at the same time.
Can you expand on hyper time a little bit?
Imagine time without space.
So does this mean that it's going both ways in all directions at the same time?
Only one direction. Okay. That direction could bend, right? If it bends, it will sooner or later become circular. There's no reason why it would be linear. So you allow, in process of everyone, the Jainists of India, Jainism, you know, it's the exact opposite of Zoroastrianism, but that's why it's so fascinating. It's like Bonita Roy probably agreed with me, that Jainism in India is like the feminine opposition to the masculinity of Zoroastrianism. I'd love to hear her thoughts on that.
Is it total?
Because she runs with Taoism in between the two. She would have a perfectly Taoism if I said that to her. She would say that, but that's because there's the Jin and the Jang, because the Jin is the Jainism and the Jang is, of course, the rest of them. And there's a point to that. The Jainists are right fundamentally in the sense that there's no God there but eons of time. And these eons of times that can be 60 million years or whatever you want it to be.
Kalpas, they're called.
Become circular eventually. Yeah. So everything is being recycled. So don't worry about the world because
big,
everything
massive
is just
fields
reincarnation
of time.
Reincarnation. And that's true.
Yeah.
I am a Jainist too, except that I've chosen to be a Zoroastrian, which is to choose the impossibility of the phallic experiment. That's what defines Zoroastrianism in relation to Jainism.
Some of my favorite students in India are Jainists. The heroic that you're introducing here.
Yes, the phallic. Although it's impossible.
We do it anyway.
To be phallic in front of the massive matrical universe. That everything is being reborn. And we're going to go further into reincarnation, you and I, eventually, obviously, because it's going to be part of the next book as well, because we haven't really written about the reincarnation of the archetypes fully yet, but we will. Okay. But anyway, the lesson learned from studying Jainism parallel with Zoroastrianism is that Zoroastrianism enables the phallic exception. This is very Lacan, very Zizek, very Freudian. You hear that right away. The phallus enables the exception from the rebirth of everything into its next rebirth. That's the name of the phallic, is the event. And it has a positive content. It's not a death. The event, an eventology, is an ecstatic occurrence that changes history forever.
So is this a counter to negatology? Because if you just have negatology, I think that you're just going to fall into this sort of existential nihilism on some level. But if
maybe
you have negatology,
Catalast is working on it. Yeah.
And if you have negatology and you have a positive principle as well, then at least, you know, at least you're acknowledging both sides of.
I think Cadell is welcome and probably will borrow our eventology to balance the negatology, because there's the negation of the negation in Hegel. The negation of the negation in Hegel is Hegel embracing the event. Hegel is a positive philosopher.
Yeah, sure. Okay, I got
that. He just understands the negation of the negation is no longer it's the completion of the negatology, and therefore the negation of the negation, I would describe it as the completion of the negatology, beginning of the eventology, enabling the event to happen. If the event happens, it changes history forever.
Yeah. Well, the question I have, I wouldn't say it's a problem because I don't know Hegel well enough to say that, is like, what about all the weird shit you do, the weird religious shit you do on faith and all that? Is that just because Hegel wants to transmute everything into logic, you know? Yeah. And for me, there's all kinds of trans rational practices that I think that the Hegelians would just look at me as like, you know, negate that or something.
Yeah, I'm not Hegelian in that I believe in his philosophy. I mean, he's also got problems with his way of redoing history. He's just a brilliant methodologist. I'm more Hegelian than Hegel, because
so perhaps the danger is making Hegel into a god of some kind, and then
what's
useful about Hegel is his incredible ability to teach you how to think.
Just read his Prejudice About Africans, and you get sick of him right away. So no, he's incredibly much a very human German from the early 19th century. He's just got a fantastic way of doing methodology. I mean, after Hegel, you learn how to think.
Yeah, right.
I am a pan-dialecticist. I'm more dialecticist than Hegel himself. I think everything that we know of in the known universe is dialectical by nature.
So pan-dialectical means everything is dialectical. Okay.
Yeah. Not just thinking, as Hegel assumes, but everything is fundamentally dialectical.
Right, physics, not just thinking, too. So other activities of the senses.
I would even say dialectics is the only principle I would apply on every known emergent vector that we know about. So physics, chemistry, biology, subconsciousness, as I call it. I don't call it consciousness because we're hardly ever conscious. But you know, anything we could think of like has radically changed the world forever once it happened, and the world is different because of it. The emergences of history that themselves have their emergence vectors. And of course, then we look at human history, we have the paradigms, and we look at it the same way. Okay, at least the way we do language, the way we talk, the way we memorize, the way we write things down, the way we print it and distribute it, the way we now interact with it, the way we now have basically all the data of the world is communicated with all the data of the world in real time. A space has disappeared. It's the internet age. Yeah, these are certainly events. And if I'm sitting there with some Chinese woman from India, she must say all the time that, well, it's all illusions, isn't it? And I'm just like, not really. It has dramatic effects on my life that I'm sitting here talking with Andrew on a laptop and recording a Sweeney versus Bard conversation, which would have been impossible 20 years ago. That's an event in itself, at least for you and me.
Technology is an event.
Technology is the most obvious event in human history. Because human beings are trying to catch up with the technological innovations. And this is the argument against Hegel and his logic. The argument is that innovation doesn't occur with a philosopher sitting underneath a cork tree. No. Innovations occur when engineers make terrible little mistakes in the laboratories and the mistakes leak out. So the events are technological, they're not philosophical. This is a mistake in Hegel. We're then dealing with the consequences of technological innovation and try to adjust to it.
Just to push back on that, wouldn't ideas affect how the engineers behave? Or, you know, so isn't there a complementarity?
No, all the wrong ideas. Okay, it's called the guillotine syndrome. Because Guillotine invented the guillotine and was killed in a guillotine. Gutenberg assumed when he invented the printing press that we would all read the Bible in our own local dialects. National languages weren't invented yet. They were invented because of the printing press. He thought we should translate the Bible from Latin and Greek, this fantastic book, the Bible, and translate it to local dialects around Europe and call them languages, German, English, Swedish, whatever. And they would all read the Bible at an affordable cost because of the printing press, and we all become good Catholics. What happened was the exact opposite. Everybody read the Bible because they could not read it and afford it, and discovered what a shitty book it was, and started burning it and destroying it, whatever. The Christians tried to save it by doing a reformation, which was basically saying that, oh, by the way, let's redo Christianity so that a person who reads a printed Bible can feel that it's their book and they can talk to God directly. You have to offer them something more to stay within Christianity. You can talk to God directly anytime you like for free. Yeah. Imagine having the world's best therapist with omnipotent power who talks to you at any time you like. Okay, Christianity is the biggest lie ever. And it was even worse when he became Protestant. But that's what Protestant Christianity promised anybody who read this sicky book, the sicko book called the Bible, and declared it fantastic. So the people just discovered it was crap. And that led to the European Enlightenment. People realized that they could write better books than the Bible. This book here, Protestant Man, is better than the Bible.
Better than the Bible, yeah.
It's better than the Quran.
I love the Bible, Alexander.
But it's a lot better than the Quran.
There's much I don't like in the Bible, but there's much I do. So we are using the Bible when we talk about exodology and stuff.
This is a better book than the Bible.
Okay. Yeah.
Most of what philosophers produced the last 40 years is way better than the Bible.
Yeah. I'm
even Sloterdijk is
super attached to the first part of Genesis. Anyway,
no, you're just being guilt tripped by your mother in Canada. That's all there is to it.
My mother's an atheist and hates the Bible.
Great, I love her. Now listen to your mother.
Yeah.
No, listen. The Bible is incredibly overrated. The Quran even more so. I mean, if I'm going to be honest here, I'd compare the Quran to Mao's Little Red Book and Hitler's Mein Kampf. They're on a par. You know, it's not a good book. It was quickly written by Solomon the Persian to seduce the masses. And why I'm critical of Islam and Christianity and original Buddhism is because I do not believe in these Gnostic fairy tales any longer. I do not believe that these religions that appealed to the masses and counted the souls and went for the quantity are worth of being around any longer. I think we can finally, hopefully, at this paradigm shift, go to the point where we want to do religion of quality. You know what you're going to do then? You convert to a religion that tells you got to work for 70 years to convert to it. You don't convert to Disney religion that offers you a hamburger with a coupon.
No. Well, yeah. I mean, I trust the religions that don't want to convert you and actually want to push you away. So that I agree with. You know, get out of here. You're not ready. You know, work.
Well, you and I made our choices based on that. We chose Vajrayana and Thoracinism, have discovered along the path that they're basically the same religion anyway. And, you know, Trakton Kepa, we're both fans of, I think, is one of the most brilliant men alive in the world today. It's just that's where it's at. It is with the Silk Road tribe. That's what we should say.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So what's...
The pantheology and the atheology is followed by a third category, which is the entheology. This is embracing the multitude and the plurality of existence. This is Bergson's question. Why is there so much of everything? That should be the fundamental question in philosophy. This is Nietzsche's and Deleuze's question.
How to deal with excess.
Exactly. Or as Nietzsche said, there's nothing less than two. Imagine how radical that statement is and how true it is. Okay, this blows up the one of the pantheology. This blows up the negation of the atheology too. The atheology says, no, there's lots of shit out there. There's to begin with both negation and the universe as a whole, which is the only one that exists. It's the universe as a whole in the present.
There's
David Bohm is absolutely right.
Infinite expressiveness of
dynamic. No, not infinite.
You don't like the word infinite.
No, you're never allowed to use the word infinite. Even Sloterdijk has banned the word infinite, by the way. Yep.
Why? I mean,
Cheating. It's sloppy thinking.
It's sloppy thinking. Okay.
There is nothing infinite.
I see what you mean.
There's just enormity.
There's just enormity. Well,
If
it's
you mean
infinite
enormity,
from
say enormity.
our perspective. Like when they say a kalpa in the Hindu tradition, they mean such a big amount of time that is impossible to conceive of.
Exactly. And that's enormity when you translate to English and not infinity. That's
All right.
exactly why the Indian and the Persian texts have been so badly translated. The Gathas wasn't properly translated until Pablo Vasquez came around a few years ago. Pablo Vasquez, fantastic Panamanian American guy, convert Zoroastrians like me. His translation of the Gathas is the first proper English translation that understands the culture where Zoroaster wrote the text. Anything else been filtered by Muslims and Christians to fit in with their fantasy about Zoroastrianism, and it's all bullshit. Zoroastrianism is the most misunderstood religion ever.
Okay, what's misunderstood about it? Maybe you want to go into
Everything.
that. Okay, well, what?
Everything on Wikipedia is wrong.
Yeah. You mean that it's a
Which is
religion about good
great.
and evil and that kind of thing? Or,
No.
well, I know it's not. I know that, but that's the
Exactly.
primary idea that people have of it. It's about good action
The
versus
two,
bad action.
the concepts of good and evil are invented in fairy tales for children. I can tell you what, Zoroaster was not a child. He didn't write fairy tales for the masses. He constructed a religion for an elite. He expected the elite to follow the religion. He did not expect the average Joe or the average Jill to follow his religion at all. He called his religion philosophy. He invented the term philosophy. Zoroastrianism is the birth, the beginning, and the end of philosophy.
Okay, so in that sense, then philosophy and religion are the same thing.
In Zoroastrianism, yes.
In Zoroastrianism, yes. There's
Meaning that anything you can prove
like
that
no
it was wrong
difference.
yesterday is changed today. You cannot have a dogma per se in the religion except that you pursue truth no matter what,
Yeah.
which is exactly what
It's a bit
Zoroastrianism
like Zen,
does.
like you kill the Buddha, you don't accept any kind of dogma or
Zen and Vajrayana are incredibly inspired by Zoroastrianism. I'd say they're more Zoroastrian than they're Buddhist.
Yeah, you say that. Yeah.
But hey, Bodhidharma?
As a Buddhist, I can only push back against that, but
No, well, the Buddhist term was just added to add some Indian flavor because India was Xiji. So India was chic. So everybody said that Bodhidharma was an Indian prince. And everybody said
he's
Padmasambhava
not a
was an
Buddhist,
Indian
he's a
prince.
Zoroastrian. He's
And
not a Zen Buddhist, is
Bodhidharma was a fucking traitor from Afghanistan, right?
it?
Padmasambhava was a fucking traitor from Tajikistan. They were Central Asians. They never set foot in India. Neither Bodhidharma or Padmasambhava ever set foot in India.
Well, they went to Tibet. He went to Tibet, not India.
They had bought in Tibet already, which is highly sophisticated, and basically reformed it into Vajrayana by adding Zoroastrian elements to it. And then it was called Buddhism. The reason I love it has nothing to do with the Buddha. I'm highly critical of the Buddha. The Buddha and Christ are in there with the Gnostics. Not impressed. But the Buddha was a California New Age guru. That's a bit it. But after him, Buddhism got its
No, he
good flavor.
wasn't, Alexander.
He
I'm too
was.
much of a dogmatic Buddhist to accept that. But I
What, do
like,
you look down
but
on California New Age gurus or
on the
what?
other hand, in the Tantric tradition, Padmasambhava is more important than the Buddha. But
Yes.
we also like the Buddha. I've got
Hey,
him back here,
Martin
man.
Luther is more important in Protestant Christianity than Christ. You know, Calvin is more important in Calvinism than Christ. The reformers are, of course, more important than what they refer to. They just refer to something to get a root of the phallus before they claim to be the phallus. Luther said, "You follow me, or else you're not a Lutheran." That's what reformers always have to do.
So what are the central like axioms of Zoroastrianism, properly stated?
You get up in the morning, you meditate. Your meditation is a contemplation. You can do Buddhist meditation, go towards the zero state if you want to, and be an atheologist, or you can be an entheologist, meaning you embrace the multitude of the world, which Zoroastrians choose to do. What you do when you meditate, you start separating your thought patterns. That's their feedback loops. And these feedback loops are called, the feedback loops are the umata, the hukta, and the vashta. So the feedback loops are then becoming to you either constructive or destructive to the best of your mind. Your master, best of your mind, your supreme mind, is what sees the different feedback loops in your life and you start separating them. You drop the drush, you drop the bitterness, you drop destructiveness, you drop things that shrink people, including yourself, in your in your surroundings.
Hmm.
You drop the destructive relationships. You look at the constructive relationships and you nurture them and you feed them. You smile before them, you love them, you let them take over your heart and your mind, and you go ahead and pursue the ashta during the day. When you pursue the asha instead of the dru, you become an ashavan. You're a Zoroaster. You follow the asha and you personify the asha. You're an ashavan. And when you personify the ashavan, you spread asha vahishta, the produced, the cultured asha. Humans can spread around the world. It's the asha vahishta.
Mm-hmm.
So the process is
three steps. Ashtavahisha means a culture.
It's the cultured
that
asha.
You create.
So asha is just true.
You're culturing something.
Asha is the Tao in Taoism is exactly the same word. It's borrowed from Persians. The asha, artha in Sanskrit, artha, asha in Avesta is Tao in Chinese. It's the same thing. It's how the world works. You live in accordance with how the world works. So this is where we agree with Hegel. Nagel's logic. You live logically according to how the world works. You can also, on top of that, add experimentation
according to the
and
Tao,
build laboratories, which Hegel does not understand. But, you know, that's Hegel is not an artist, so he's just a philosopher. So you'll put it that. But anyway, you go through the humata. The humata is to think through your thoughts properly to their very end and complete them and discover whether the thoughts are constructive or destructive. Are they asha or dru? That's humata. Then, when you've done that process, you make the hukta, which is like swearing an oath towards yourself and your brothers and sisters around you, your community, your anjuman, the sangha in Buddhism, anjuman.
Yeah.
You swear to the anjuman that you're committed to doing asha.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hukta. So humata hukta. And then the rvashta is the practice. The rvashta is the entire day you practice what you decided and swore you would practice, and that's your day.
Yeah, that's
the
like
next
primordial
day you repeat the process.
Because all of those things you mentioned, I can see within my own tradition. So it's like that is the primordial religion in a sense, what you've mentioned, right?
Yeah. But it's a religion without the superstition.
Mm-hmm.
It's a religion without saying that your grandfather died, but he's gone to heaven. It's a religion without the lie. It's not a religion that permits any sort of lie. No matter how noble, you don't live in the world of Druj. To yourself, you must live in absolute truth, and that's called Asha.
Mm-hmm.
That's Zoroastrianism for you. So it's very close to Hegel and his philosophies, you can discover. Hegel loved Zoroaster, so did Nietzsche. They studied the guy. And, you know, Iranics, or studying Iranian history and culture and language, was high fashion in Germany in the 19th century, and these guys were very educated, much more than we are now. They literally read Avesta and Sanskrit, and there was the Germans in the 1830s and 1840s that helped the Zoroastrians in India and Iran to take the Zoroaster's own text out of the Avesta and then call it the Gathas. There was clearly an original author who had written these songs, Gathas, that had a real stern quality to them that did not permit the supernatural at all, that cleansed your mind from stupidity and you know, beliefs in the supernatural, anything like that. To
that
be
sounds
totally
like early
grounded
Buddhism
in reality.
Because early Buddhism had very little of that in it.
Yeah. So, yeah, Buddhism is definitely different. So Buddhism is a spinoff from Zoroastrianism about 1,000 years later. I said early
Buddhism because...
Yeah. I kind of think the Buddha could have been an Afghan. He could have been Afghan rather than a northern Indian. We might never know. The original Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a problem. I think he's a very healthy, good Gnostic reaction to the Zoroastrian mission. So both Buddhism, original Buddhism and Zoroastrianism, deal with how you get out of the eternal return of the same.
Yeah.
And this is Buddhism is the fundamental negatology.
Well, what I think that Vajrayana adds...
Zoroastrianism is an eventology.
What I think Vajrayana adds is the whole magic, shamanistic, you know, element.
Yeah,
in its various sort of, you know, expressive practices.
Well, I tell you
elaborate
what,
practices.
I tell you what, the drugs in India were terrible.
Mm-hmm.
They had nothing in India. India's poor on drugs. It's like Europe. It's poor on drugs. Okay? Tibet, Mongolia, Persia, drenched in fantastic drugs. Zoroastrianism is the only one of the world religions that embraces psychedelics. It's called Homa.
Homa just means psychedelics?
Zoroaster says that Homa should be locked in and used wisely as a tantric practice.
Okay.
That's what Zoroaster writes in the Gathas.
Mm-hmm.
The Homa.
The Homa, and that's a psychedelic Yeah, it's not, it's different than an intoxicant or, you know,
no,
like.
No, the Homa, we have found evidence of Homas in contemporary Uzbekistan. This is Russian archaeology, with at least 9 different highly psychedelic compounds mixed into one bottle. The Zautars blew their brains out. So if you're into psychedelics, go Zoroastrian. This is the religion where you don't have to excuse yourself for taking interest in psychedelics. It is a religion that totally embraces psychedelics. It's called the Homa. The Soma in India later is a very much weaker and milder version of the Homa, because India only had opium and it had only cannabis and what else did they have? Shrooms, right? They had nothing else to cook your Soma from in India. So the Indian yogis never had the chance to drink the potent drinks that the yogis of Central Asia drank.
They smoke a lot of hashish or something.
You know, they did whatever they could and took tons of it. But, you know, we do what we can with the material we have, right? So, but they had the ugly wife of the Persians or the beautiful wife. Let's put it that way. And the same thing goes to Peru and Mexico. And that's where we had these conversations about Peru, Mexico, and Iran being 3 psychedelic superpowers, you know, because the most potent drugs available for shamans to drink and have fun with existed in those 3 places. Not in Africa, not in Brazil. No, they existed in Peru, Mexico, and Iran. So the only tradition we have in Eurasia along the Silk Road is a psychedelic tradition of contemporary Afghanistan and Iran. So this influenced Vajrayana. Certainly influenced Vajrayana. And this is what when we take Vajrayana now to the West, we interpret it as a new tantra, a Western tantra of sex and psychedelics and psychoanalysis. That's the way to do it.
So what else, Alexander?
So you got Bonita and Layman to come over to Parallax.
Yeah, we did. And OG Rose and a few other people. Maybe this guy named Jeremy Johnson might do a course. We want to do courses at Parallax, little mini courses.
Yeah, I think you do wonderful, wonderful work. I love you and Tom to bits. I think Parallax is just amazing. And I want to stay loyal with you guys because you've been loyal to me. And why don't we ask the people who watch this conversation who they think should possibly be good guests with Sweeney versus Bard? Because I would like to do with this season, having these conversations, not too often, but on a regular basis, is to go deeper where we already are.
Yeah. Yeah, you were saying. And so, like, where's the territory? Where do we need to go?
We need to understand attentionalism. I've been adamant about this. I've asked Alex Ebert, maybe this is where he takes off and does his own philosophy. He'd be perfect for it. Maybe I am with some new collaboration, or I don't know, John wakes up in 3 months' time and says, yeah, let's go for a self book. I have no idea. I have no idea. But I think attentionalism is the most important topic today, and people don't realize how important it is. Okay. Advertising, marketing, dead.
Yeah.
Politics, dead. Academia, dead. That means all the old institutions are dead. They will try to corrupt the algorithms with money. They will try to manipulate the algorithms with politics. They're doing their best to conform us all through mass media and academia and call anything that they don't like fake news or whatever. Okay? So we're being attacked on all fronts with the old institutions. Doesn't mean they're powerful. It's just that we tend to believe that old power has a power, but they're all Versailles. And the rest of us are now in the streets of Paris. And in the streets of Paris, we have the internet. And we have YouTube. And we have Parallax Academy. Mm-hmm. And we have all the tools we need to kill them. And we will. The question is, what do we imagine we're killing them for to replace them with? What they provided was called capitalism. And I've never bought into the anti-capitalist mode at all. I think it's ridiculous, infantile, sloppy, boring. Shishik is the
it's
last
more like
one.
What's next is the more important
I'm totally Marxist in the sense that it's deeper than capitalism. It comes out of capitalism, and we have to go through capitalism fully before we can understand what comes next. But here's the hint. We called it attentionalism already 25 years ago, and the work needs to be done. Mm-hmm. So on attentionalism would be the discovery of what is not for sale.
Mm-hmm. Let me add something, because I was speaking with Cadell about And I was trying to push the idea of worship on him, because I think worship is attention. And that's exactly what I was saying. Like, what you pay, what you are erotically engaged in the most fundamental sense, what you worship, what you pay attention to, that's like, so attention is everything. So I like the term attentionalism. I mean, you're talking about it more on a, in a political sociological sense, but like, it's the fundamental thing of religion as well.
I totally agree with you. This is very sharp. Attentionalism is a phenomenological term for an historical period. So it takes us away from capital towards attention, because attention becomes more important than capital.
So this means that we're moving into a more religious. Yeah. It's not a move. It's not just a economic Marxist thing. It's a movement towards religion in some sense.
It is more Marxism than Marxism. So it is taking Marx seriously as a religious theologian. We use Marx in Protestant event. We think of him as a Jew who's obsessed with the Exodus. But the Exodus is no longer in space. The Exodus is in time. It's a paradigm shift. The first thinker of paradigms is Karl Marx, not Nietzsche. Mm. Karl Marx. Mm. That's why Nietzsche ends up with nihilism. Marx does not. Mm-hmm. Because Karl Marx imagines a new chosen people that he calls the proletariat. They're leaving Egypt. That offer anybody to join if they want to, and most people are too scared to, so they say no, and they stay in Egypt, and they stay slaves forever. That means the people who are now being told that you could leave capitalism, they will stay with capitalism, they will stay with anti-capitalism, be obsessed with both. If I'm terrified of anything that Cadell might do, is that Cadell might line up with a sort of anti-capitalist, anti-neoliberal academic left, and then we'll lose Cadell there, because I think it's the dead end. Todd McGowan, these guys, Slavoj Žižek, they're done. We have to think, be more Hegel than that. We have to think capitalism beyond and deeper than capitalism itself. What capitalism forces us to do is that it takes us and grabs us by the neck. And then it says, what's not for sale? Why do you think I work with sex workers? Why do you think my Marxist product at the moment, recording, is sitting down doing anthropological interviews with sex workers? Because sex workers are the best Marxists you could find today, because they know the difference between sex and love. Because they're sex is for sale, love is never for sale.
Yeah. Sex workers are the proletariat. That's very interesting. That's
cool. They're the Foucauldian proletariat.
I like that.
If Foucault had been around for another 30 years, it would completely have agreed with me.
So, like,
this was key.
George, when George Orwell says there's hope, where there's hope, it's in the proletariat. That's where the hope is.
I left queer when queer started going on about being victims. Mm-hmm. I was in queer because queer was about pride. I emphasized my bisexuality as much as I could to be LGBT in the 1980s and 1990s. And by the way, they needed protection because everybody was persecuting them and AIDS came along. But anyway, I was totally with LGBT.
Now it's pride. I left in 1990. Pride and victimhood. It's not pride and.
As soon as they started doing the victimhood cult, as soon as the fat straight women joined the LGBT movement with their problems, and they were not persecuted, they were fucking straight. They just had a diet problem, right? As soon as the fat straight women joined, I was out, and most of the gay guys left too, because they were more interested in partying and having sex and having fun and doing great fashion than being political. Bless them, right? But LGBT after 1998, I was out. And the reason I was out was because I didn't participate in that at all. I believe in queer pride fundamentally. And queer pride doesn't have to force anybody to be queer at all. It's so fucking good on its own that it flies.
It's just that's pride in love, who you are.
That's why I love the intellectual deep web, which is now full of transgender people who have a fantastic story to tell about where they're at. And basically, we're now in the intellectual deep web inventing four genders. Woman, trans man. There should be four.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, you were at three before. Now you're at four, hey?
I'm at four because we should respond to Jordan Peterson and say, woman is not trans woman. That's the radical way of confronting Jordan Peterson with his bullshit today.
When
Jordan Peterson says trans woman is not woman, aggressively, bitterly,
then the
response to that is that fine, the woman is not trans woman, and trans woman was interesting now, not woman. We've done woman. How about that, Jordan?
So are you saying that he's right, but in the wrong spirit? Or something like that.
Oh God, I want Jordan Peterson to come out as a trans woman because he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh God, that would be so liberating.
He's so right and he's so wrong at the same time. It's very
It'd be
interesting.
So right if he just wore a dress and felt comfortable in it.
Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah,
Oh
I agree.
God,
I'm with you there.
I'm waiting for full circle. You know, I'm a total Hegelian. I believe go deeper and deeper and deeper and complete the movement, and then you see the light. Complete the movement. The end
Yeah.
of the tunnel is literally only if you pass through the entire fucking tunnel.
I love
I
Jordan
want to go
Peterson. I
through.
think he's stuck, though. I really think he's very stuck.
Oh God, he's a
I love him,
benzodiazepine.
but he's stuck.
No, I'm
I have some
bored.
love
I'm
for him.
bored with him.
Yeah,
I'm
I'm
bored
bored
with
with
him.
him too, but there's
I want the
something.
Nietzsche and the Jungian back in
Yeah.
him. I want the fucking new Christian shit out. I
Yeah.
want the real Jordan Peterson to return before he became famous. I want the real. But anyway,
Yeah, anyway.
bless him. We'll be in dialogue with these guys, obviously. Well, but I would say that the trick today, when you asked about existentialism, I think that's the big topic coming up in the next few years, whether I pursue it, other philosophers do. You can only think existentialism your first thought paradigm. Habermas, Sloterdijk, do not think paradigm. There are no paradigms there. Marx does. Marx thinks paradigms. You can start from Marx. You have to start, or McLuhan. You have to
McLuhan.
start with somebody who thinks paradigms. Hegel, McLuhan, Marx you can use because you have to think paradigms. Once you think paradigms, you start thinking, in what way is our world different from the previous world? And in what way has nihilism already been overcome? Nihilism is only the lack of imagination when the paradigm dies.
Yeah. You call you
Affirmative nihilism, which is
we're in
the
a
end
kind
of
of you
nihilism,
called
the
the
freedom,
supernova at one
is the
point.
establishment of the new elite who love the world and love the future and love to build shit. I'm going to live in places like Roatán, Honduras, and Zanzibar and other places to find people who build brand new communities today, use cryptocurrencies and whatever they want to do just to go beyond the capitalist world as we knew it.
It's interesting, Alexander. You're a Marxist and an elitarian.
Marx
So,
was too.
and you're saying Marx was too, but that's the opposite of what
No,
people think of Marx
he
was. So,
hated woke. Karl
yeah,
Marx would
but that's
hate
not
woke.
how
He
people think
would
of
hate
Marx.
today's
People
left
think
has
of Marx as the
nothing to.
people, not the
The
elite.
only way to be Marxist today is to be an extreme right Marxist. I'm coming out as an extreme right Marxist, and Brendan O'Neill in the UK has promised to join me. We're starting the extreme right Marxism train
Extreme
right
right
here.
Marxism. Okay. Well,
It's the only way to do it.
I don't know if that's
Marx
what
loved
we
the
can
elites. He
pack.
wanted to. He hated the lumpen proletariat in the streets of London. He was not about justice for
Well,
all.
what about the worker and all that?
Oh, but the workers should be. They were justified to get paid better for hard
Yeah.
work. Conditions in factories in the UK
But
in
they
the
weren't
1830s
the
were
elite.
terrible.
There was some sort of thing
You
for the
would have been a
underdog.
Marxist if you lived there. You would have been a Marxist easily.
Oh, yeah.
You have to
Everybody.
understand where he wrote the
Well,
book and when he
I
wrote it.
remember Kandera was saying everybody was a Marxist before, like the Russian Revolution. Every good person was, or something like
Forget
that.
about all the people who call themselves Marxists. It's a bit like you have to go back to the guy. So the difference is that Christ is mediocre, whereas Marx is brilliant. Let's start there. Marx is brilliant in the sense that he imagines, he's a Jew, he's a new Moses, he imagines a new elite that can establish itself a new paradigm to affirm themselves, and therefore the nihilism of the previous paradigm is their victory. The starting point is that, oh, you become nihilist, off you go. I'll take over, I run the show because I'm not a nihilist, I'm affirmative. I believe in the future, I believe in the world, I believe in creating an event inside this process, and I want to personify that event. That's where I think Marxism has to go theological and understand its religions, and Karl Marx has to be read as a Jewish theologian. Once you do that, you understand where all these crypto communities and all these things are happening. And what they're looking for is this. The road from capitalism to communism doesn't go through socialism. That was a terrible mistake by Marx and Engels and the guys that followed, leading into Stalin and Mao. Big mistake. No. The road from cap, we're not Hegelian. We allow experiments, even if they're bloody. We have to, right?
So we skip
So
over socialism and go straight
you go
to
capitalism to
communism.
attentionalism, and attentionalism is the road to communism.
Oh, cool.
This
Okay.
is laid out in Process and Event at the end of the book as a kind of this is where we need to go next.
So not socialism, but attentionalism. That's
Yes.
radical. That's radical. That's
Yeah.
amazing.
But it makes sense because capitalism, thought through to its very end, leaves us it was more valuable to us than anything you can buy. And for people like these who could afford it, like an Elon Musk, he could afford it. Well, I have fuck off money in my bank account too. At least you can't buy me either. And for anybody who you cannot buy any longer, who's not a whore any longer, who's therefore not a slave any longer, they're free to rethink the world. And what they will pursue is nothing but the attention that cannot be bought. Their own attention, other people's attention that cannot be bought. Wait a second. To live in a society where you prioritize the attention of yourself and others, where the algorithm correctly reflects the world in a Zoroastrian manner, where the algorithm is true, where the algorithm is free, where the algorithm is open and cleansed from corruption, manipulation, and conformation, and it reflects you and where you're going.
Well,
that algorithm is so priceless that this is what Elon Musk and all the guys would pursue. Once they pursue that, they moved into attentionalism, capitalism over.
So, I had a thought that negative attentionalism is narcissism, right?
No.
It's just a thought. That's a negative form of attentionalism.
There's
it's like
no
you're,
narcissism
you're just paying
involved.
Attention
no,
to...
Narcissism is the end. It's exactly what capitalism exposes, because the narcissist can only buy his attention. That's not attention at all. Any attention that's bought, it's not attention. It's just pretending to be attention. It's fake attention. Commercials are fake attention. We just flip through them and we call them spam, throw them in a box, and we hate it.
So it's like, to each according to his need, or whatever this Marxist phrase is, people will pay attention to what, you know, this elite or whatever will pay attention to what matters or to truth, rather than paying attention to Netflix, garbage.
What Marx meant when he said that was not to each to his need, was not that obese Americans should have more hamburgers. He literally meant it. To each according to his needs.
Yeah.
You're only supposed to get the resources you should have to maximize your creativity.
To maximize your
creativity.
Any good
boss
yes.
knows that.
Yeah,
Any
yeah.
good boss is a good Marxist.
Yeah,
in the sense that, no, you don't give them more money than that for the startup, because if they get too much money, they get too lazy, employ too many girls, have too many hookers, and take too much cocaine. No, don't give them that much money. Give them exactly the money they need to pursue the product and finish it. That's what Karl Marx needs when he says to each to his own.
So that's the proper measuring of attention or something still, or I don't know if measuring is a word, but
no, okay.
Distribution of attention.
Algorithms measure attention. And if you want to tie the attention to something in time, so it cannot be argued with, you use a blockchain. The algorithm is one side of a coin, where the blockchain is the other side of the coin.
Okay.
This is the most revolutionary tool ever invented.
Why?
It will change the world forever. It will stop human beings from lying.
Can you explain?
Because it's impossible to lie without your algorithm exposing that you're lying. That's how good algorithms will be. Trust me. I'm the digital Marxist here.
Yeah, they're going to be able to make everything transparent, all the lies transparent, I guess.
Isn't that
dangerous? Like, what about the transparency business? Like,
no,
the danger of transparency.
No,
ultimate
it won't
transparency.
Be transparent at all. No, it will not. Okay. Elon Musk is not transparent. Elon Musk has a private life. Elon Musk doesn't let you know what he's doing in his spare time at all. Peter Thiel moved to New Zealand, built a house inside an atomic war safe bunker.
Okay.
They're not interested in you seeing anything. Transparency is over. It was Christianity. It's over. The new power will not be transparent.
But if the sensors can sense everything, your lie, then will you be able to escape to a desert island and
no, the sensors will tell you what they cannot know and what you cannot know. That will be the most valuable asset of all in the attentionless society. It's called sacredness. It's called secrecy. It's called the closing of the door to the temple. It's called aditonology in Barton Sedeka's philosophy. It's fucking brilliant.
I like that.
We'll figure it out. But attentionalism is the name of the game.
Can you say that word again and explain it?
Aditonology.
Aditonology?
Aditonology. Aditon is Greek for the inner sanctum of the temple. So aditonology is the rules and laws that are valid for the inner sanctum of the temple, they're not valid for the outside world. It's tantra.
Got it.
It's the specific rules and laws, or lack of them, in the tantric sphere compared to the sutric outside.
Okay.
Must be contained. But that's the space where power resides from now on, historically. So the autocracy will rule inside an aditonology that we will not have access to.
I was going to say, maybe it always has spiritually, if that doesn't sound too
it will be more Freemasonry than ever. So the conspiracy theorists are right, except the conspiracies haven't happened yet. But the world will be ruled by conspiracies. Yes. Let's have a lot of them.
Let's have more conspiracies.
Yes. Let's have more Dubais, more Singapore, more Djiboutis, more Roatans, more city states we can move to.
More hidden temples of activity.
And when we vote, we move. Democracy is dead and over, but we can move. It's called migration. And we could do the exodus and go to somewhere else. We could do exodology. What do you think? My philosophy, John, is full of these things.
Or you don't even have to go somewhere else. You can just be here, you know, in a sense, right?
You can be by your laptop.
You don't have to move geographically.
You can be an autist like Andrew and Alexander Bard and live according to the maxim. Wherever my laptop is, that's my home.
Or live near a forest somewhere. That's what I like.
You and I have so much to talk about. This is amazing, Andrew.
This was great.
In our conversation.
I think we're back. We're back. Sweetie versus Bard is back, everybody.
We didn't finish the theology, though, where we started. So the fourth category that we allowed and added in the Synthesis book is Sin Theology.
Mm-hmm. Sin Theology, right.
Sin Theology is imagining what hasn't happened yet. And that cannot be done through logical process. And here's the end of Hegel. The science of logic cannot provide you with this in theology.
Yeah.
Because Syntheos would probably be created by accident and suddenly just be obvious.
I want to go deeper into that.
That's why people are obsessed with the book. That's why people buy Syntheism now 10 years later because of AI. Hey, the subtitle is Creating God in the Internet Age. And we're saying God will probably be created. It would be an accident.
Mm-hmm. Just a lab accident, like a virus.
You know what's beautiful with accidents? You can worship them before they happen. Religion allows that.
Okay. You mean
you sort of prepare for
the Messiah that hasn't come, like in Judaism or something like that?
Yes, the Selshiant that hasn't come yet in Zoroastrianism, the Messiah that hasn't come yet in Judaism, the Mahdi that hasn't come yet in Islam, the Savior hasn't come yet in Christianity. Any religion that dealt in any form of linear time has to deal with the Messiah coming. The Selshiant, right? The Selshiant will happen. It's bound to happen. It will happen by accident.
It'll happen by accident. Yeah, it will happen by accident.
And if potentialism has happened before, God comes. God will introduce communism. Mission completed.
That's wild, Alexander. Just
it's theological Marxism for you.
Totally
Marx
wild.
Is back. Marx is back.